And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of Nerdy Notions with Sasha Kaplan.
I'm Sasha Kaplan, and welcome to another edition of our marvelous misadventures through the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I get this part.
Fine.
Because we already discussed how I have to be the lead-in for this one.
This is true.
And ladies and gentlemen, one of the many reasons why I'll forever remain single, because now we're going to be talking about the man that Sasha, not only Sasha, but pretty much every woman on the planet wants to marry, Mr. Chris Evans, Captain America, Winter Soldier.
Yes, so we're talking about part two of the Captain America trilogy. And I have to say, this movie is amazing. I love this movie. This movie is just so good on so many different levels, not to, you know, go off everything and give
away.
Well,
not only that, but this is also the third movie of Phase 2.
This is true. And so far, Phase 2 kind of sucks.
And it's the movie that brings life back into Phase 2. Because then it builds into what's next is Guardians of the Galaxy. And then obviously we hit another dud with Age of Ultron, but then finish it off strong with Ant-Man.
And so, like, Phase 2, for some reason, is very much up or down. I think part of it is lack of a consistent direction for where they wanted the Phase 2 to go. Because I think, because you have, like, a lot of director issues, a lot of issues between Marvel and said directors, a lot of other problems that seem to be going on. And as we talked about last week with Thor Dark World, Thor Dark World is a snooze fest. It's boring. It's clunky. The villains are generic and uninteresting. And so Winter Soldier comes at a point where people are kind of starting to doubt whether the MCU can hold its own. With three Thor Dark World. Now we're kind of wondering, all right, well, Captain America, the first one, a lot of people had mixed feelings about. So let's dive in and see what we have to say about the Winter Soldier. Captain America, the Winter Soldier.
Listen, I know Chris Evans is a massive hunk and he embodies what Captain America really is via his Twitter posts.
Well, we'll agree to disagree.
But, I need you to keep calm, keep the heart in the chest, and
there's a lot of muscles. I might not be able to contain myself, so you'll have to reel me back a little bit if that happens.
It's why I'm here, because I know I'm not that good looking. So the ugly has to bring down the hotness of Chris Evans from time to time.
I told you, it's my job to make fun of you. Stop doing my job for me.
It's too easy.
Fine, have it your way.
Don't worry. For those who don't know, Sasha will always find a way to get her pot shots in on me.
Anyway.
As she blows the finger guns.
Pew, pew. Anyway, so we are tackling on Captain America the Winter Soldier, which is based off the comic written by Ed Brubaker of the same name. This is actually one of the first films that I actually read the comic for. And unlike a lot of the other films, Iron Man, The Avengers, where they were pulling from various different iterations of the Avengers, various different parts of the canon for even the World War II version of Captain, World War II time of Captain America, even with Iron Man and all that jazz, they were still pulling from a couple of different canons. With Captain America the Winter Soldier, that is a very specific comic that came out in the early 2000s. And the question is how are you going to adapt the comic into the modern fray of the MCU and keeping it intact but also keeping the story kind of on its own? So let's dive in. I will be doing a couple of comic book comparisons because I can't help it. Not all my comic book comparisons are going to be negative, actually, towards the movie or the comic. Or will they be? We shall see.
Dun, dun, dun.
So we open on a lovely morning in Washington, D.C., filmed actually right in Washington, D.C.
At the National Mall.
At the National Mall. We see a lovely man, a very attractive man named Sam Wilson. We don't even know his name yet. As he's, you know, casually jogging in the morning. It's like 4 in the morning. The sun hasn't risen yet. And Steve just like flies by and goes, on your left. The second on your left, you can actually see it. It's filmed from inside the Jefferson Memorial, which is really cool. And you can see in between the columns as Steve is running past Sam again on your left. The final on your left actually happens at the cusp on the reflecting pool. But on the cusp between, you kind of see Lincoln, and then it veers off towards Vietnam, actually, if you go further backwards. So I know DC, and so does Michael. So this comes
in. Oh, yeah, because I've lived down here for over 30 years, and how long did you live down here?
I keep going back and forth, so you never know when I might come back. But anyway, so, and then as he steers, Steve's like miles ahead, and Sam's like struggling to keep up. He's like, oh, I can't do it. And then we actually see the World War II Memorial in the distance, which is kind of a nice shot. Funny enough, the next shot is right in front of the Capitol building. So Sam must have felt good enough to make it across the mall. Make it across DC, you know, that part of DC towards the Capitol. And he's like chilling on a tree, and there's Steve.
I don't think Sam is really chilling at the tree. I think he's trying to catch his breath because Captain America just whooped his ass in running.
I mean, Captain America could probably whoop anybody's ass, so like he shouldn't feel bad. But anyway, so
best quip is about to come up. You're going to get to it. The best quip.
All right. If I don't get to it, you'll have to jump in. Anyway, so Sam and Steve introduce themselves, and he's like, yeah, I'm Steve Rogers. And Sam's like, yeah, I kind of figured that with the whole running thing. And
then that's where the best quip comes in. He goes, I don't think before they do the introductions, they have like the interaction, and Sam goes, you good? You know what? Why don't you just go do another lap real quick?
Did you just take it?
I just took it. Yeah, that's the quip. That was such a good quip.
It was a good quip. And then they introduced themselves. And Sam's kind of like, must have been a kind of weird, you know, going, you know, being frozen and coming to the present. He's like, eh, it's not so bad. No polio's good.
But then they talk about, you know, sleeping in the bed.
So there's a reason why there's part of the scene where Steve's like, oh God, another one of those, like, people have talked about this scene. And one of the things that I've seen a lot is people saying that, like, oh, Steve actually reels back because Sam's kind of doing the whole, oh my God, it's Captain America. He was frozen in the ice thing. But Sam tackles it back and actually goes, it's your bed, isn't it? And so they talk about how Sam did 2 tours. He was in the armed forces, and how, you know, he was there. He was like sleeping, you know, using rocks on the ground, yep, using rocks for pillows, and how Steve feels, he adds to it and says like, oh, my bed feels like a marshmallow, like I'm gonna sink to the floor.
It brings a realism to it, because, you know, there's a lot of people who, when they come back, this is the reality of what they're dealing with. It's like, yep, they're not used to being able to sleep in an actual bed. Heck, even in boot camp, you know, they're sleeping on like literally wood boards with like a paper thin mattress. You know, they're not sleeping in what we would consider an ideal situation, where we get to have a box spring and a mattress and nice fluffy pillows and stuff like that. So, exactly. You know, it brings a lot of good realism. And it actually grounds Captain America too, having that realism
and
to it.
We see this grounding actually throughout the entire film.
And that was a great way to start it.
It is an absolutely amazing way to start it. And we will see more of this. So Sam works at the VA, and he's like, hey, if you ever want to, like, you know, come to the VA and make me look good in front of the girl that works the front desk and whatnot. And then as Sam recommends something to Steve. He says, that he needs to listen to Marvin Gaye's 1972 Trouble Man soundtrack. Tells him, like, it'll be everything he needs to know. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Marvin Gaye was from D.C., wasn't he? Or am I confusing him with somebody else?
I think so. Well, let me look that up real quick.
I want to say yes. Did my training pay off? Anyway.
Hold on. Marvin Gaye is, yes, he was born April 2nd, 1939 at Howard University Hospital in Washington, D.C.
I know my stuff. Anyway.
Oh, but you ready for the irony of this? Passed away April 1st, 1984. So he passed away the day before his birthday. That's actually sad now. Now I'm depressed.
That is a little sad. Anyway, on to happier things. Steve has a list. He says he will add it to the list. What's really cool is that the list is actually slightly different in some of the countries that the movie was screened to add some cultural references to the countries. There's like Star Wars, Star Trek. There was a couple of other things that were on that list. The Twin Towers, I think, were also on there.
Feverish typing.
So he had it. So on the to-do list, and I have to look it up because there's the list is so cool. He has I Love Lucy, Moonlighting. Oh, I'm sorry. I take that back. I apologize. It's not the Twin Towers. It's the Berlin Wall. I thought about like it went up and came down, but it was the Berlin Wall. You have Steve Jobs, Disco. My God, Steve's handwriting is atrocious.
Disco, baby. Yeah.
Thai food, Star Wars. For some reason, there's a cross at Star Wars. I'm guessing he watched that.
I would assume if he has it crossed off, he probably took care. He knocked it off the list.
So Nirvana is a band, Rocky, and then there's like in the parenthesis is Rocky 2 ? And then the Trouble Man soundtrack.
I also love how he just pulls out this like out of nowhere. He just pulls out this little booklet.
So actually what I love, thank you, Marvel Cinematic Universe Wiki. God bless you. There's a couple of other things on here. In the UK version, apparently, it also included the Beatles, the World Cup 1966. I don't know why that matters.
Was probably a big game.
And then it says TV shows, something. I don't know. It's kind of hard to see. But
if it doesn't have Whose Line Is It Anyway, they did it wrong, damn it. Or Monty Python.
Yeah. So on the Korean version, it says Dance Dance Revolution, Jisung Park, and it says Old Boy and 2002 World Cup.
That one makes sense.
In Spain, it's interesting. It says Rafa Nadal, Chupa Chups, which is the best like lollipops ever. Heroes del Silencio, the 1978 Constitution, Camilo José Cela. If I butcher any of these, I apologize profusely. For Latin America, it had Chilean Miners Rescue, Maradona's Hand. Oh my God, that's Madonna. Maradona's Hand of God, Shakira, Neri Vela, the first Mexican astronaut, Octavio Paz, Nobel winner. Italy, World Cup champion, 1902-2006. Jasper Rossi, the Berlin Wall, Roberto Benigni, Ferrari victories at Formula One Grand Prix.
64 country versions later.
All right. Steve Irwin is mentioned in the Australian and New Zealand one, along with AC/DC and
Kangaroos. 65 countries later.
Okay. Shush. All right. I got to Russia because I'm from Russia originally. So you got Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space. Vladimir Vysotsky. You have Soviet Union Dissolution of 1991. Moscow Does Not Believe in Tears, which is a very overrated movie. Let's see. There's a Louis de Funès, which is in the French one. He's a great French actor. If you need to, actually, this is a good movie recommendation. It's called The Mad Adventures of Rabbi Yaakov.
I think I've heard of that.
Louis de Funès is a actor. He plays like this very snooty, obnoxious, very racist businessman who has a Jewish driver. And basically basically it's the shenanigans that involve with him and how he ends up getting involved with this Arab guy and how they end up having to dress up as Hasidic Jews to go to escape from like bad guys. And it's hysterical. Highly recommend. There's a couple others, but those are the most important ones. Yeah. All right. So that's the fun. That's fun. But so afterwards, Natasha shows up and she says, I have it here. She says, excuse me, gentlemen, do you know where the Smithsonian is? I'm here to pick up a fossil. First of all, rude.
But so funny.
It is funny.
Which, by the way, we should throw this out there super quick. Since you brought up Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow, the movie has been delayed. The Black Widow.
And so has the New Mutants movie for the umpteenth time. That poor movie, as I'm convinced, is just never getting released.
This time, though, it's because of the coronavirus.
I know, but before that, it was because of the Fox deal. Before that, it would be because of something else. And before that, it was because of something else.
But we have a guarantee it's coming out, though, because of the fact that we can't help the fact that we're dealing with a pandemic. And thank you for listening during this time. You have many podcast options, but you chose us, and thank you. it is what it is. I mean, a lot of movies are being put out digitally now because they can't go in theaters. Like Bloodshot, starring Vin Diesel, is being released digitally now.
I mean, that movie tanked anyway, so...
Yeah.
All right.
I don't think the promotion for it was good, and I think everyone wanted Jason David Frank to play the character, not Vin Diesel, because Jason David Frank was actually already the live-action Bloodshot for some other stuff.
Yeah, well, we can't always get what we want.
Nope.
So we'll continue.
We found the fossil.
So Steve gets into the car with Natasha, and Sam's like, he tells Sam, we can't walk everywhere. And Sam's like, no, you can't.
Wally stares down Scarlet.
He stares down Black Widow, yes, yeah. Natasha. Anyway, so basically they end up in the Indian Ocean over the Lemurian Star, which is like a ship that is something to do with S.H.I.E.L.D. And there's $1 billion ransom. And S.H.I.E.L.D. was where they shouldn't have been. And then these Algerian French-speaking terrorists, for obvious reasons, have taken over the ship. And Sitwell is on the ship. And so is Batroc, who is a comic book villain from, like, longtime comic book villain of foe of Captain America's. So Steve is the boss, and you have the Strike Force team, which is kind of led by Rumlow, who's... Like, he just looks like a bad guy. Like, oh my God. Like, this is a man that has I am a villain in this story written all over his schnoz. Okay?
And he made his debut in what film? In the MCU? Avengers.
Did he really?
Yeah, he was on the carrier. He was one of the people where he was the one who was the one that identified Loki.
The more you know. So all of the guys, Steve's gearing up for the mission. Meanwhile, Natasha is like trying to set him up. She's like, and then she's like, well, what are your plans this weekend? And he's like, well, all the guys in my barbershop quartet are dead. So this is actually a reoccurring theme of Nat constantly trying to set Steve up. She's like, well, what about this girl? And what about this girl? And Steve is like, this is part of the struggle of the film. It's Steve is now in the present and he understands that. It's kind of like, and I think Chris Evans actually talked about this in an interview where he's talking about now it's kind of trying to find his place and like where he fits in into the current. And like things are different than they were in World War II. Like Steve says this himself, like people trusted each other, like compared to now. And we live in an age of, you know, vast mass information and social media and all this jazz. Anyway. So Steve basically just like jumps from the ship and Rumlow's guys ask like, was he wearing a parachute? Did he have a parachute? And Rumlow's like, no, he doesn't. So they, Natasha's job is to secure the engine room. There's some really amazing action all throughout this movie. There's a great fight between Buttrock and Steve.
Now, the person who played Buttrock was George St. Pierre, a retired UFC fighter.
That's awesome, actually. Yeah. Because the fighting choreography also was so on point. I especially like that twist that whether it was Chris, I think it was Chris, actually. I don't think there was a stunt double for most of this, for this scene at least. If there is, I apologize, but there's a twist where he like kicks up and does like this cool like cartwheel midair, just like that was kind of fun. So basically Rob Lowe's guys rescue Sitwell. Meanwhile, Natasha is let's see. She's saving SHIELD Intel basically. And there's a scene where like Steve kicks Buttrock into the server room. Or the computer room or whatever of the ship. And there's Nat. And she's like, well, this is awkward. And she's like, what are you doing? I had a, like, I told you to do this, blah, 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 blah. And that's like, oh, it's not that bad. She's like, you compromised the entire mission. She's like, and then she's like, okay, there's like an explosion. She's like, okay, that one's on me.
So real quick, I just want to throw this out there real quick. I made a mistake. The Agent Sitwell character actually debuted in Thor.
Yeah.
In the MCU, he was in Thor because he was part of the site of the of Mjolnir, and then he was in Avengers as part of the carrier crew. That
actually, wait, he was in a short.
Yeah, he was in the Marvel one shot, The Consultant, in 2011.
Which like tied it up, yeah, I tied a couple things to.
But that came after Thor.
Well, anyway.
But yeah, that actually came after Thor to, I guess, kind of feed a couple, like, plot holes, I guess.
So, yeah. So Agent Sitwell. So Sitwell is rescued off the ship, and he, like, tells the Algerian terrorist, like, oh, you know, this is, SHIELD doesn't, I told you, SHIELD doesn't negotiate. Also, Steve is like king of the guilt trip because when he tells Natasha that, yeah, it's on you, she's just like, this is like your grandfather telling you that you disappointed him.
Actually, one of the best things about like that scene also is that like when they see like the grenade come in and they have to like run for the glass, Natasha shoots the glass before they run into it.
Yep. Also, like Natasha's fighting as she's like going through the guys in the engine room is really well choreographed. How she like wraps the line around one guy and then uses him to like lower herself and shoot. And like, it was really well done. So then we kind of head back to DC, where I guess the setting of the carrier is actually, or of the SHIELD headquarters is actually like off of Roosevelt Island, sort of, just kind of cool. I know that doesn't tell anybody anything, but like for me as a nerd who loves DC, like this is big.
As filmed in Cleveland.
Yes, we know. So Fury takes Steve is mad at Fury because Natasha had another mission, and you know they're like, it's an inconsistency, like things can go wrong and you need everybody to be on the same page. And Fury's like, well, I don't want you to do something you're not comfortable with. Agent Romanoff is comfortable with everything. And I'm like, this is not a good way to run an operation, but whatever, Fury. So then Fury takes Steve down to like their
basement
pretty much, where there's like these giant helicarrier carriers that are being developed, and this is Project Insight. And like on the way down, Fury tells him a cute little story about his grandfather and how like the neighborhood got rough. Like, you know, he'd have these like all his tips from working in a hotel, which I guess is actually something that actually happened to Samuel Jackson's father, I think, that he actually did work in a hotel or grandfather.
I'm on the IMDb, so keep going, and I'll let you know if I find anything.
Yeah, it was his grand operation in real life. Samuel Jackson's grandfather was an elevator operator. Okay, close enough. So Steve is like, what is the purpose of these helicarriers? Like, this is a little iffy. And Fury's like, oh, these are great. They have the new revulsion technology because Tony Stark got in there and like had some advice from the events of Avengers. And this is, I guess, like after the events of New York, Fury had this quantum surge analysis thing, and they're ahead of the curve, and you know how this is going to terminate a lot of threats before they happen. And Steve's like, this sounds kind of iffy. And Fury's like, well, we're part of the greatest generation, but you still kind of fudge things up and had to do things that weren't comfortable. And Steve says, you know, we did this so that people could live free. And, you know, and then he tells Fury that this, like, that what he's doing is not freedom, it's fear. And it's actually this concept of freedom versus security is kind of pretty prevalent throughout the film. So afterwards, Steve is kind of done for the day, and he goes to the Smithsonian, which was actually, funny enough, filmed at the Air and Space Museum, even though rationally it should have been at the American History Museum. At the time, the American History Museum was being renovated, so they had to film at the Smithsonian, at the Air and Space Museum.
Yep. And ironically, at the time of Captain Marvel coming out last year, the Air and Space Museum, which is where I got to see it, was also under renovation, so you couldn't see half the stuff that you wanted to see there.
Oh, I know. That was happening, like, all of last spring and well into the summer, I guess. Did they finish it finally?
I don't know. I haven't been back over there yet, and I kind of can't.
I can only hope.
And I kind of can't go there anyways because they're closed.
Yeah, now's not a good time.
Yeah. Although the one thing I want to see get back put up is the dinosaur exhibit in the Natural History Museum. Oh, you too.
I'm sorry. I made a face. I don't like that. I don't care about dinosaurs. I don't. Like, I get bored at the, like, I went to the, sideline. I went to the American Natural History Museum in New York, and there's a whole bunch of dinosaurs. I'm like, oh, look, a skeleton. Oh, look, another skeleton. This is fun. Let's move on.
Well, it's not just that for the DC one, because it's a smaller exhibit compared to what it used to be.
I know. But I'm not a fan of natural history. Like, that's just not my thing.
See, I like natural history.
Give me, cool, like, Indiana Jones's hat. Give me an ancient Torah scroll.
One of the museums, the one that you had to pay for in DC.
That narrows it down.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, I can't remember the name of it. But
the museum?
No. Wasn't
the museum. The spy museum?
No.
The building museum?
No. But they had an Indiana Jones exhibit. And I actually paid like the $12, like, because my buddies and I, we all went, and we went for the Indiana Jones exhibit. That was actually kind of cool.
It must have been, was it National Geographic?
That's what it was. Yeah.
There it is.
Okay. There it is.
Anyway, moving on. Sorry, I sidelined.
This happens a lot on podcasts. Just,
I know. So Steve goes to the Smithsonian, and it's kind of cute because we do get kind of like a reminder about some of the stuff that happened in the first event, in Captain America, the First Avenger. We also get some nice bits about like the Howling Commandos, and we hear from President Ellis. President Ellis is the president that we saw in Iron Man 3. So he doesn't actually appear in the film, but you kind of see his name. I guess after somewhere in between like First Avenger, Avengers or Avengers, and then like Winter Soldier, Steve got like a nice handshake with the president, maybe did a little PR tour or whatever. Just to verify, it was probably after Avengers, you know, just so everybody knew that this is the real, honest to God, America loving, pie eating Captain America. Anyway.
But one of the nice parts about the Smithsonian though was the Bucky exhibit. Yeah. And then also when Steve watches like the videos and he sees Peggy Carter. Again, yeah, this is part of the grounding.
I know.
So I know you roll your eyes, you hate Peggy. I know.
I don't hate Peggy. I hate Lois Laning her. As like Steve's ultimate love interest, which is like, no, Steve's one and true love is Bernie Rosenthal, and people can fight me on this. But anyway, so there's a scene in like the little theater where Steve is sitting and Peggy is shown in like from, it's footage from 1953 where she gave an interview that talks about how Steve was, some one mission that Steve did and how one of the men that Steve ended up rescuing that day was actually somebody that, who would later become her husband. I believe later on in Agent Carter, it's shown that that's Agent Sosa, which would have been so cute. And then,
and fun fact, if when I do get the archive up of the experience, I interviewed the actor who played Agent Sosa.
That's awesome. He's cool. I liked him.
Yeah, it was, Enver Gokai. Jokai, I think it is. Super cool guy. But yeah, that archive will go up because I asked him specifically about doing the Agent Carter show.
That's awesome. I can't wait to hear it.
Whenever I get the archive up.
Right. Then we flash to a scene where Steve actually is talking to Peggy. She's still alive for another couple years. And it's kind of cute because, like, he's asking for her advice, and she's one of the founders of S.H.I.E.L.D., and that's part of the reason that he joined. And then there's like this moment where he's like asking her for advice or something. He's like, I'm not sure what to do with my life. And Peggy was, it looks like she's about to tell him to go and get a life. But then the Alzheimer's, she clearly has dementia. And she like, I don't want to use the term resets, but she forgets. And so you get to the scene where she's like, oh my God, Steve, you're alive again. And you just see the pained look on Steve's face. I'm like, yeah, that hurts. I get that. And they did a really interesting job with like aging Peggy, which was CGI, but it was really well done. Like it looked cool. I liked it.
Yeah. And I can touch base on this because my grandmother had Alzheimer's. It's like, you know, how they did that was kind of right because it's like, I remember my grandmother couldn't remember who I was. So the fact that she had enough memory to remember who Steve was, but then have those lapses because that's what happens.
Yeah, you know, it was good.
And it was just another level. You know, now we've had our third grounding moment and we're only probably like, what, 20 minutes into the film?
Yeah, lots happened in those 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So then we get to the Lumarian star. Oh, yep. We get to the data off the Lumarian star. Fury's trying to look at the files, but he can't access them. So he runs a decryption. He still can't access them. And then the AI lady is like, that, you know, entry prohibited or whatever. And he's like, by who? It says Fury Nicholas J. So I think Fury at that moment realizes that something isn't right. So he goes up to the 40th floor where we see Director Pierce talking to the Security Council, who we sort of saw in the first Avengers, in the Avengers movie.
But with some slight differences.
With some slight differences, because they're not hidden anymore.
Well, not only that, but the other thing is that one of the members had changed because Powers Booth in Avengers was on the Security Council and he had passed away. So they weren't able to use Powers Booth again, so they had to put in a different person.
Did they? Or they just like cut one person out instead.
I don't know. I'd have to go back, but I swore that they had four the first time.
Yeah, it's four. No, wait. I think they had five the first time.
We'd have to.
But
go
I might be wrong.
We'd have to go back and look.
It honestly doesn't matter.
But honestly, a lot of people were disappointed about it though, because A, Powers Booth was a really good actor. And two, I think certain scenes, especially like with Robert Redford,
would have been good.
Would have been really elevated just between having Samuel L. Jackson, Powers Booth, and Robert Redford on the same.
Well, room. Gosh, fandom, I'm so sorry. The guy passed away. You didn't get your moment.
I know. Hey.
Anyway.
Those of us who were fans of him in the show Deadwood on HBO, we were really disappointed too because he couldn't do the movie either. So.
So Fury goes up to Pierce, who is played by Robert Redford, who is an absolutely incredible actor. And who actually did this movie because his children, his grandchildren.
Grandchildren.
I just made him like 40 years younger. He should thank me. But his grandchildren were like huge MCU fans. And like, so he wanted them to see him in the movie. And I think that's really cute, actually.
And the funny thing is that he only expected him to be in just this one film, which ended up becoming him being in two. Endgame. Stark Tower. Post-Avengers. Him and... He shows up and he has the confrontation with Tony and Thor, and that's when Ant-Man does the thing to the arc reactor in Tony's chest. That was Robert Redford.
Wow, I'm like so badly blanking on that scene. But anyway,
because they're trying to steal the Tesseract.
Yeah, but the Tesseract was You're right. Because. He comes in right as they're bringing Loki out. Yes.
Yeah, Loki with the Tesseract.
Before Loki escapes with the Tesseract. Yes. Okay, yeah, now I'm remembering. Thank you.
Yep. Because we have the sexy ass versus sexy ass Captain America fight.
Oh, America's golden ass. Anyway, I can reel myself back a little bit.
I also baited you on that one. Let's be brutally honest here.
Yes, you did. But see, I can reel myself back. So Fury talks to Pierce and says, something's wrong with Project Insight. We need to delay it. And he's like, I can't just delay it. It's like, well, you need to. So I guess somehow he convinces the universe to delay it, or seems to say that he does. Afterwards, Fury is in a car and he is on his way to see Maria. Or he calls Maria. He's on his way somewhere. And he says, I need you here, deep shadow conditions.
I can be there in 4 hours.
You have three. as you can tell, we've seen this movie a lot. This is honestly like my top five MCU films. Like,
and for me, I actually will just watch straight through the entire MCU. Like, even the bad ones, I just watch straight through them all. So I see them all equally, but obviously some films more because they've been out longer.
Anyway, so there's like these two cops and they're kind of looking at Fury funny, and he looks at them like, want to see my lease?
Yeah, he did say, you want to see my lease.
Yeah. You want to see it.
Samuel L. Jackson, like this right here was him in like Pulp Fiction mode.
Yeah.
Which we'll actually reference that a little bit later too.
So there's a really cool... basically the entire scene with Fury in the car is really, really cool. Like he's basically attacked by unknown entities, and the AI in this car is like, there's no known police units in this vicinity. My favorite scene though out of this is when he's like driving the car and it's obviously like a mess. There's like nothing less. He's like, call Hill, communications disabled. Or
what is working? God damn it!
Air conditioning operating. Yeah, the air conditioning is still working.
Well, at least I know I won't be sweating to death out in the hot heat.
Yeah. So Fury, there's a scene. So then as he's driving and he thinks he got away, this man comes into the middle of the intersection and shoots something, and it's like this disc, and it attaches to the bottom end of the car and blows it up. But Fury escaped by then.
Well, no. Fury was still in the car at the time of explosion. The figure is slowly walking to the car.
But
Samuel L. Jackson pulls out his lightsaber, because why not? Because Disney owns Star Wars 2, and he cuts a hole through the hood of the car.
No one cares about the prequels.
They kind of work though if you watch it in a certain way. But anyways, Samuel L. Jackson pulls out this. He pulls
upside
out,
down and with plenty amounts of alcohol.
Yes, pretty much. But he pulls out this, like, torch thing that almost looks like his lightsaber from Star Wars.
It looks like a laser pen. Give me a break.
And he cuts...
It's not even the right color.
It wasn't about the color. It was about what it looked like. Anyways.
Star Wars nerds.
Anyways, but he uses it to cut the hood of the vehicle and also the concrete of the street to get into the sewers. Which was actually, I'm not going to lie, is actually kind of a cool... like little tool to have handy for you. So.
Yep. So.
And everyone calls it the lightsaber anyways, because of the joke of Disney owned Star Wars. Yeah, quite a few people do.
Like two.
Shut up,
you
Meg.
And like maybe three other people. Anyway.
Shut up, Meg.
Steve, rude. Steve, it took me a second, but I understood that reference. Steve ends up going home and he meets his neighbor, who's a nurse. Oh, goody.
Played by Emily Van Camp.
I like Emily Van Camp. I think she's very sweet. I think she's a great actress. I think she was wasted. I think Sharon Carter is one of the worst characters in the Marvel universe. She's just so boring. Anyway, I'm putting my thoughts about Sharon aside. And I'm not even going to touch about her being Captain America's love interest. So we're just going to put that aside. And so
we get Steve, to touch that in Civil War.
We can touch it in Civil War. We can touch it in Endgame. There's a lot of ways. Anyway, so Steve is like talking. She's like on the phone and Steve tells her like, hey, you can use my machine if you want. And she's like, oh, what's it going to cost? A cup of coffee, blah, 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 blah. He's flirty. And she's like, we already have a load downstairs, but maybe next time. And actually, she's like, oh, you left your stereo on. And Steve's like, oh, crap, somebody just broke into my apartment. So he sneaks in via the window. And it's Nick Fury. And he says his wife left him. And so they're speaking in code because there's, you know, ears everywhere. And Fury types out a couple of messages on his phone. Fury tells him basically that S.H.I.E.L.D. is compromised. And then Fury, and he gives him the USB thing. And then Fury shot. And then Sharon, Agent 13, walks into the, like, bursts into the room. She's like, Captain Rogers, I'm Agent 13 with S.H.I.E.L.D. And she calls in for an ambulance and backup, and Steve goes after the shooter. The chase scene is actually kind of fun, but there's this epic moment where Steve throws the shield and this metal arm just grabs it.
And then froze it back, essentially. Yep. Yeah.
And then that person gets away. So then we go to the hospital.
Which was also like the first moment where Captain Rogers is like, oh.
What is going on?
Somebody actually caught the shield. That hasn't happened really before. That. So that's like another moment where he goes, oh, that's not good. You know?
So we're at the hospital and Hill arrives, and actually upon rewatching this, I realized something because I was always very confused about the doctor guy that we see later on in the movie played by one of the Russo brothers. That same doctor is in this scene. And when there's a scene where you can, in that, where they're like trying to save Fury's life, you can actually see somebody else injecting him with something.
Yeah, it was Joe Russo.
It was Joe Russo, thank you.
And he played Dr. Fine, but he went under a fake name as Gozi Agbo.
Whatever. So Fury dies and Steve is summoned to S.H.I.E.L.D. for questioning, but there's a really interesting scene where like they're all standing parallel and looking at the screen, and Hill comes in, and you know, the shooter was fast and strong. He had a metal arm and three slugs, untraceable. And Natasha says, Soviet made. So Steve hides the flash drive in the hospital vending machine underneath like three packs of gum, which like, it's not the stupidest place to hide something when you have no other options.
Well, not only that, but the other thing is that I have one problem with the vending machine. I had no qualm with the fact that he hid it behind the gum. But if you actually look at real vending machines that have gum, where's the gum usually at in the vending machine?
I don't know, at the bottom?
Yes.
Seriously?
Yeah.
You're annoyed about the mechanics of the placement of a product in a vending machine?
Yes, because one of the things that it made it do by having the gum up top? It made the USB visible.
It made it visible. Details. I think it would have been visible either way, but anyway, depending on how tall you are. So Steve has to go to S.H.I.E.L.D. and Hill takes Fury's body. So So Steve is kind of peeved at Sharon because he's entering Pierce's office as she's exiting. She's like Captain Rogers, and he's like, neighbor. Steve is a terrible liar. But he meets with Pierce, and he kind of gives him, like, a half-truth. He doesn't lie, but he also doesn't tell Pierce everything that he needs to know. And so Steve becomes, you know, public enemy number one. And there's the elevator scene. Everybody loves the elevator scene. So after he leaves Pierce's office,
the elevator scene has actually turned the combination of the Endgame elevator scene and this elevator scene have now has become like the big meme now.
I don't meme.
I'll have to send you some. They're pretty funny.
Oh, joy. My dream come true.
It's your husband, though.
That's true, but that's not the, but I don't, I can look at him without all of the additional text of things that I don't care about. So Steve is in the elevator, and then Rumlow comes in. It's like, oh, forensics found some fibers. Do you want me to assemble the team? And Steve's like, we should probably see what it is first. And then these guys in business suits walk in, and then the rest of the strike team walk in as the elevator's moving. And like, Steve's not stupid. He sees that the guys are sweaty. They have their weapons in easy access. Like, the clip on the holster is off. Like, something's about to go down. And so very casually, he's like, gentlemen, would anybody like to step out of the elevator before we get started? And then he kicks their butts. It's beautiful. It's epic. I'm very happy. So Steve basically escapes. He manages to disable a helicopter with basically a shield, which is kind of hilarious and ironic because it is a shield like plane that he disables with a shield. I'm having way too much fun with this movie. So
what you're saying is I can just mute my microphone, just open up a bag of potato chips and just start eating it.
I mean, that's up to you. Steve goes back to the hospital while S.H.I.E.L.D. is basically on the manhunt. And he goes to the vending machine, and the flash drive is gone.
Because he put gum on the top freaking shelf where everyone could freaking see it.
He didn't put the gum there. Talk to the guy who had the vending machine open as they were arriving at the hospital. Boy. Anyway, so it's... Natasha is there, and she comes in behind him, and she's got the gum. And so Steve, like, takes her aside, and she tells him...
Suck it up, buttercup.
So she has the drive, and she tells him about the Winter Soldier and how most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. How she was transporting some scientist out of Iran through the Ukraine in Odessa. And that their car got hit, and she managed to pull him out without a problem. And then the Winter Soldier showed up and shot the scientist straight through Natasha. Just kind of cool and really horrible. And then she goes, bye-bye, bikinis. But also Pierce tells Steve that Fury was the one who hired the terrorists to hijack the Lemurian Star. That's very important because Fury knew something was up. So from this point, Natasha becomes his ally, but they need to find out what's on the drive. So they go to the mall. Fun fact about the mall, yes, it was filmed in Ohio, but the outside of the mall was apparently used in the Avengers for that scene in Germany. The outside, apparently. Anyway, special note there. So Steve and Natasha are at the mall, and they go into the Apple store, and she plugs in the drive and shows them, like, and they're in disguise and they wear like hoodies and they're so cute.
They're just so adorable.
And Steve is wearing, you know, glasses. And
as we both fix our glasses at the same time as you say that.
I mean, this guy could look good in anything. Like put him in a teddy bear costume and he'd still look attractive. I reeled myself back. I'm fine. I'm good. So Natasha is trying to decrypt the drive and she can't, and she, like, the person on the other end who created the drive is, I guess, smarter than she is, slightly, as she says. Meanwhile, this Apple guy employee comes over and he's like, can I help you guys with anything? And we're like, oh, we're just looking for honeymoon destinations, because Natasha says that what she can do is find the location or the source of the signal that is competing against her, that's rewriting her commands. And there's a moment where the guy looks like he recognizes Steve, and he's like, I have those exact same pair of glasses. And Natasha's like, oh yeah, you're practically twins. And the guy's like, no, he's a specimen. Like, yeah. So as they exit the Apple store, the strike team is already there. And Steve is thinking like a soldier, like, okay, there's two guys in the front, two inside. We got it. And Natasha's thinking like a spy. So as they get into the, she's like, put your arm around me and laugh at something I said. And then as they're getting down the escalator, she goes, kiss me. And he's like, what? She goes, public displays of affection make people uncomfortable, as Romulo is literally heading up the escalator. So they kiss, and then, which apparently is enough to get Romulo to look somewhere else. And then the next moment, they actually hijack a car, and they are driving to New Jersey.
Woohoo! Sorry.
Top 10 worst states in the union.
Sorry, I was born in Jersey, so.
I don't retract my statement. Top 10 worst states in the union.
I'm not retracting having you retract your statement either. There's the good portions of Jersey, and then go F off with the rest of it, you know?
That's cute that that there are good parts of Jersey.
No, there really is. I'll froze right now. Summers Point, Cape May, and Eggtown Harbor Ship, and just really those three areas, and everything else can go in a dumpster fire.
I agree.
And the reason
I somebody who's traveled, unfortunately, through quite a lot of New Jersey.
Yeah, well,
sure.
I say Summers Point because that's where my grandparents lived. And so I spent a lot of time there, and it actually was a really nice area.
So it's just the nostalgia talking.
It probably still is a really nice area, but I wouldn't know because I haven't been there since we moved my grandmother down here.
That's fair. So they are heading to New Jersey, and they have this really nice conversation in the car about where Steve learned how to hijack cars, like World War II Germany, hello. And then there's this whole thing about like Steve, and Dasha's like, was this your first kiss since World War II? And Steve's like, I'm 95, I'm not dead. So I guess Steve tried dating and realized it wasn't happening. And
either that or he did the kiss and he just really screwed it up badly that the woman didn't want
him. I doubt
it.
Anyway, so Steve says it's hard to find someone, you know, with shared experience because he's 95, but he's 95, but he's also technically like 30. Like, so it's hard for him to relate to this generation's people, sort of. And that kind of makes sense because it's the same thing if he was like a foreigner. He's essentially in a foreign country. Let's see. Where am I? The mall, life experience. Oh my gosh, I am. So they go to, they arrive in New Jersey, and it's actually Camp Lehigh, where Steve became Steve. That's where he was trained, and that's where he got the serum.
He went to boot camp.
He went to
see who would get selected for the program, and then
yes.
He had the test done in Brooklyn.
So they arrive, so they look, and Natasha's like, there's no heat signatures, there's nothing here. And he sees that there's a munitions building, and I guess there's something about like you can't put a munitions building next to within 500
yards, I think,
yards or feet or something of a barrack. I think it's yards.
Yeah,
because if anything explodes, you don't want it near the barracks.
Yep. And I also think, if I remember right, that is actually a legitimate rule too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would hope so. Otherwise, it's armed forces. We got to have a chat. So they go inside the building, and it's like kind of like where S.H.I.E.L.D. got started, I guess. There's a picture of Peggy and Howard, and as they go, they find something else. There's like a secret passageway. And she's like, why do you need a passageway already in a secret building? So they go down to the creepy basement and they find ancient computers of the 1970s. Beware.
Yo, man, that was a sexy sight, though.
Nerd.
Yeah, look who's talking.
So she notices that there's like a port where you can actually plug in the drive. So she does.
You ever find it how ironic that you have all this 1970s technology and then there's just this random USB port connector, adapter?
Actually, no, because we know that Pierce was in communication with Zola. That means if they needed the drive to be created, somebody would have had to go and make an adapter so that Zola could use the technology.
But if you're somebody like...
There's probably some upgrades that happened, but it was kind of hard to convert 200,000 disks of databanks onto like a new hard drive.
No, but okay. Let me put this in a better perspective. You're walking into this room for the very first time.
It's weird.
You have no idea about anything about this room. And you're just looking at all these 1970s technology for computers of what they had to do back in the day. And then you just see this random USB port and you go, that is a weird thing to have there.
And like Natasha kind of dwells on it for like a hot second. And then she just plugs it in. And so the computer awakens. And who is this computer machine? It is Arnim Zola, the German scientist. Oh, wait, he's Swiss. We don't care. A Nazi's a Nazi. So Zola is basically stalling while the strike team arrives, but he tells him the story about how basically they realize that if you go and take somebody's freedom by force, they're going to fight back. So what they realize is they had to think strategically. And basically that, like, S.H.I.E.L.D. is Hydra, that they're kind of behind a lot of the, like, big assassinations. They're responsible for killing of Howard Stark, probably JFK too, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is all part of a ploy to get people to sacrifice their freedom and to Hydra's control. In this case, it's again, like, how much freedom are you going to sacrifice for the concept of security? And Zola uses the question of, like, he kind of hints at, like, surveillance cameras being an example, et cetera. I mean, it's an interesting question, especially in today's world, but it doesn't really shove that question down your throat. It sort of, like, plants the seeds and lets you kind of dwell on it on its own. So you can think about it further. And that's something, that element of like planting seeds and having the audience think about it actually kind of trickles into Civil War, but we talk about that when we get there.
Yeah, we only got we only got 3 movies to go to get to Civil War.
This is true. So Zola's a jerk and is stalling, and the funny thing is they do mention Operation Paperclip, which is a real thing. The United States government took a whole bunch of Nazis with strategic value and repurposed them. Because you can always trust the government. That's a joke. That's a joke. Anyway. So,
just to let people know, there was this awkward stare between Sasha and I on that one. As she now drinks her water, because this is the moment where she gets to drink her water because I'm talking. Notice the strategic value of that.
I see what you did there. So
dumb Tish.
Basically the strike team bombs the bunker. I wonder if Zola managed to hide himself in that flash drive. He's gone.
Actually, no. Because as we find out a little later on, they go, no, we lost Zola.
Oh yeah, that's true. He is actually gone.
Because we get to that point a little bit.
Yeah, we do.
Real soon, actually.
So obviously Nat and Steve survive. And somehow they,
because of quick thinking.
Yeah, because S.H.I.E.L.D. is magic, man. It is vibranium. But no, the S.H.I.E.L.D. basically saves their lives. And quite often, I think in at least three scenes, Steve just like grabs people and just like hides them under the shield because that is the kind of man Steve Rogers is. So they go back to DC to Sam's house because Sam is fine.
Sam's just chilling, bro.
Did I think we missed the scene, a scene though.
I think we missed the scene where Rogers
goes to
in.
The VA.
Yeah. But it wasn't that, like, I mean, it's a good scene, but it's not a noteworthy scene.
This is true, but I think it does kind of touch upon what we were talking about earlier about how there's a lot of grounding elements in this film, and one of those is the VA. And, like, that woman who's talking about how she got pulled over because the officer thought she was driving drunk, but she swerved because she thought she was going to hit an IED, but it was, like, a plastic bag or something.
Yeah.
And that's real. People go through that. So I like those realistic elements that were poured into the movie to try to ground it and bring it.
I'm going to throw this story out there. There is a guy who I went to high school with. All he ever talked about was joining the Army. When he did, and he went for boot camp, they were going for the guns training, and it caused him to have a seizure. Because of all the loud pops and stuff.
Yeah. Ooh.
As a result.
Bye Army.
As a result, he was discharged. And that alone put him into shell shock and stuff like that. So it's like, so there's that realization of like, you know, you hear these bombs going off and then all of a sudden it causes you to have a seizure or something else. That can really mess with you mentally. And he has not been the same. I haven't heard much about him, but the last I heard, he was not the same person he was in high school.
Like, can't imagine he would be.
Yeah. Like it just changes you in so many ways.
Oh, wow. That got dark real fast. But,
well, when you talked about a dark moment, what did you expect, you know?
That's very true. And so that scene serves two purposes. It does ground the movie, but it also kind of continues this relationship and friendship between Sam and Steve to the point that Steve feels comfortable then coming to him in a crisis. And Sam, at the beginning, in this moment at the VA, it tells him about his best friend Riley, how they were sent in on a mission, and Riley died. And there's this kind of implication that Sam did something and he's kind of like a pilot or something. And they don't dwell too much on it, but they kind of plant that seed.
Yeah, because the key line was is that he lost his wingman.
Yes, there we go.
But now we fast track back forward. They go to Sam's.
So it's morning. Sam just comes back from his run, and there's Steve and Nat looking kind of banged up and at his doorstep, like, hey, let us in. And there's also like nice moments of friendship between Nat and Steve that we could talk a little bit about later. But point being that they talk about the fact that they have to stop the helicarriers. And Sam just kind of like drops a file on his desk, like, consider this my resume. And they realize that they also need to get Jasper Sitwell, the algorithm, and Sitwell, because Sitwell was on the Lumerian Star, so Sitwell has to know exactly what's going on with the helicarriers, because they don't know they need to stop the helicarriers yet. I backed
up. Yeah. Well, not only that, but the interesting thing is that when they're looking at Sam's resume, the first thing that Steve goes is like, I thought you were a pilot. I never said pilot. It's a good moment there.
And it's actually really cool because Nat's like looking at it strategically. She's like, were you using a stealth chute? He's like, no. The thing is they need to get the suit, but it's at Fort Meade and it's like behind, you know, armed guards and three walls. And Steve and Nat just look at each other like, no problem. Like, we got this. It's fine.
We've been through worse. It's okay. We got this.
Yeah, so in between like having breakfast and grabbing Sitwell, they break into Fort Meade. Like, oh man. So speaking of, we go to Senator Stern from Iron Man 2. And he had just had lunch with Agent Sitwell at the Occidental. And this was actually filmed at the Occidental restaurant, which is a very cool place. Very expensive place, but very cool. Very, very, very expensive, but very nice place.
Peons anyway. Like us can't go there.
I went there once.
Peons like us are not supposed to be there.
Anyway, so Stern is telling him how he's gonna back home to meet with a constituent. He's got like a young and hot sexy thing that's like messing up his back. And they hug, and that's that moment, the one that sparked everything, the whisper of, "Hey, Hydra." Like, let's be honest, we all knew that Stern was a dirty senator anyway. Like, we knew that from Iron Man 2.
Yeah, you know, as he says it, you know, he's just a little prick.
Yeah, except he was looking at Tony when he said it, but like, look in a mirror, man.
Yeah.
Sitwell gets a phone call and he thinks it's from the director. And so he says, "Yes, sir." And Sam's like, "Hey, how's it going?" And we see very obviously that like Sitwell is kind of a loser. Like, he's just kind of a derp. And so he's like, "You're 10 o'clock." And he looks in the exact wrong direction. He's like, "Your other 10 o'clock." He's like, "Well, why should I go with you?" And there's like this flash of like that laser from a scope. He's like, "Cause that tie looks real nice." So Sam, Steve, and Natasha kidnap Sitwell and they take him to the roof. And Steve's like holding him, and he's all about like Sitwell's about to fall off. And Sitwell looks at him. He's like, "That's not your MO, Rogers. Like, you're not gonna throw me off the roof." And Steve's like, "Yeah, you're right. It's not. It's hers." And Natasha just like kicks him off the roof. And then of course Sam rescues him off his lack of red spandex suit.
But it's the beginning phases of the Falcon.
This is true.
Hey, you gotta start somewhere.
I know. So basically, Sitwell reveals that the Lumerian star and all of the data on it and the concept of the three helicarrier is basically like insane targeted killings. It's like basically very cleverly orchestrated mass murder of literally anybody Hydra doesn't like. Bruce Banner, Stephen Strange.
And I was just about to say, you know, Stephen Strange. That's the first mention of him
in the MCU.
In the MCU, yeah. So it was like, it was really interesting that because I think at this point they'd already announced Doctor Strange was going to
happen. They hadn't.
Oh, they hadn't.
There were rumors, but it hadn't been confirmed yet. That was the confirmation.
I think it was shortly after the movie came out. That's when they announced Doctor Strange was happening.
4-ish years later, we got Doctor Strange.
As part of Phase 3.
Yep. It takes time, guys. Gotta be patient.
Yep.
So they're gonna use Sitwell to get back into S.H.I.E.L.D., but Bucky shows up and the bad guys show up and Sitwell's killed pretty quickly. Bucky just like grabs him, like throws him away, basically.
Well, first off, you're calling him Bucky, which, yeah, obviously by now, spoiler.
Yeah.
It's Bucky, but
like, I can't help it. I've read too many comics. But yeah,
but we still don't know it's Bucky yet.
I mean, if we've read the comics, we know it's Bucky.
Yeah, but for the casual moviegoer who's just going for the film.
This is true. I think if you don't actually know that, it must have been like an amazing twist. I'd like to love to hear from someone who has not read the comics and who didn't know what the reaction was like, because I would have loved to see that. Because I remember my reaction when I read the comic at first, for the first time, and I got to that page where we actually see him, and that the line, you know, "Bucky, who the hell is Bucky?" straight from the comics. Yep. And that reveal, I was like, "Wait, what?" Anyway, we're getting to that. So basically, there's the Winter Soldier blasts him with like a rocket launcher, basically, with some, and it like knocks Steve back because of the vibranium and the shield, pretty far away. Nat like can't compete with a machine gun, but she manages to. So in this scene, the Winter Soldier's face is completely covered up. You cannot see his nose, and he's wearing goggles, like completely covered up.
And I think that actually, I think at the point, at the beginning part, he loses the goggles.
So I'm getting to that. So yeah. Nat manages to shoot at him enough that it grazes the goggles, and he has to take them off and abandon them. That's the only thing the handguns can do, basically. There's also, I have to point this out, bad choice of Russian. So there's a scene where he says, she's mine. Except she doesn't tell them that she's mine in Russian. That would have been Anna Maya in a very like blockbuster action movie sort of way. No, he actually says, Anna u меня, which basically means like I have her, but it doesn't quite work in Russian. It more means like I have her, like she's presently here with me. So that line doesn't really work, but you know, it was said so fast. The average viewer doesn't speak Russian, but like, come on. Come on. TV movies, you can do better. There's enough Russian speaking people in Hollywood that you can do better. Fight me. So Nat's obviously not a match for Bucky, but she does manage to put up a decent fight. Then she kind of gets shot. Sam can hold his own pretty well. He does a good job. And Steve let's see. So Nat gets shot and Steve comes to her rescue before she can get shot again. And there's this, the fight choreography is amazing in this movie. It's gun versus shield versus arms versus knives. And I think Sebastian Stan actually trained pretty well, trained a lot, like on how to handle the knife, like playing with it and everything, to the point where like he's actually pretty good at it. So that was amazing. And so there's this fight and they're fighting. And at one point Steve grabs him and the mask comes off. And then it is revealed, 'tis Bucky. And so Steve says, Bucky? And this like completely shocked and exhausted face. And Bucky says, who the hell is Bucky? So the gang is captured by SHIELD shortly after, or Rumlow, and they're like ready to shoot them. And there's a news crew on the helicopter and he's like, not here. So Steve is quote unquote arrested. And as they're in the car and they're driving and everybody kind of thinks that they're being taken back to SHIELD for questioning when they're actually about to be murdered. They're like, no, she's shot. You got to help her. And somebody like uses the like electric wand and Sam's like, oh great, I'm about to be shocked. And the other like attendant in the vehicle, the other security guy, gets shocked and the helmet comes off and it's Maria Hill. So Maria takes them to a secure location filmed in Ohio. And it's a bunker. Meanwhile, the truck arrives to wherever it is that Rumlow was taking them and he goes, start digging, we need 3 graves. And then they open the trunk and there's nobody, truck, and there's nobody there, or van or whatever.
So just to let you know, when we get to a later scene, I actually have notes on the Security Council.
Ooh, okay.
That's why I've been quiet, because I'm looking up something on the
Security Council. I figured you were doing something.
I'm doing shady things, yo.
So they get taken into the bunker, and we see Joe Russo again, and Maria's like, she's lost a pint of blood, and Sam's like, 2 at least. And Joe Russo's character's like, I'll take her. Because she's been shot. And Maria says she'll want to see him first. And then, I'm so shocked! Nick Fury's alive! I can't believe it. I didn't see it coming. No, come on. Everybody saw it coming. It's Nick freaking Fury. He doesn't die. So
it's just like Shaft. He doesn't die either.
I don't know what that means.
You never seen the Shaft movies? Okay. I think it was last year or the year before, they came out with a Shaft movie, and it starred the original Shaft, Samuel Jackson's Shaft version of Shaft, and then the new actor who played Shaft. It was literally a you can't kill Shaft.
Okay.
You're just like, whatever.
So basically, Steve, they all kind of... Hydra is fixing Bucky's arm because Steve kind of put a shield in it. And Bucky's starting to remember. So here's a fun note. One of the guys in the room who are the quote unquote doctors, the one without any lines, is actually Ed Brubaker, who wrote the comic, which is why I think every single Marvel movie from now on needs to have its creator in the cameo. So, like, if you're basing, like, if you're going to redo Days of Future Past, you better give me a Chris Claremont cameo. Otherwise, what's the point? So Pierce is trying to get the mission report from Bucky. Oh, wait, we missed another scene, actually. It's kind of important. I mean, I guess it's a little bit important. There's a scene earlier where we're in Pierce's house, and he basically tells Bucky, the Winter Soldier, the asset, as he's been referred to in the beginning of the movie, to, you know, kill these three targets, and that's, or kill the two targets, which is Steve and Natasha. It's not very important, but it basically establishes bright and obviously that Robert Redford is the bad guy.
Yeah, and if killing the nanny didn't take it off, come on.
She's not
guys.
The nanny, she's the maid.
Whatever. Killing the maid didn't tell you that he's the bad guy, you know.
Oh, there was a cute, there's a couple of, like, we'll go through, like, the Easter eggs in the movie, I think, at the end, but so he's remembering, by basically Pierce is like, oh, he's useless right now, wipe him and start all over. I'm like, oh my god, you evil like, that's, well, just so evil.
Well, not, like, only that, but if you also notice that Bucky's also kind of in a catatonic state at the same time, because he's trying to process what went down in this mission.
Let's be real, his mind is a little bit of a mush.
Yeah, well,
considering how many times he's been wiped and twisted. And he does actually have a flashback to, like, getting picked up from falling in the snow and getting his metal arm and Zola and, yeah, being put on ice.
Yep.
So basically they agree that they need to link the we're back with Maria Hill and the gang, that they need to link the three helicarriers together on one server and then blow them up, basically, or turn them on each other and blow them up. And Fury's like, well, we need to salvage S.H.I.E.L.D. And Steve's like, no, we don't. It's donezo. Like, S.H.I.E.L.D.'s gone. It's time. Let it go.
May it rest in pieces.
Pieces. So there's a very cute flashback of, I think, them coming back from what is implied to be, like, Steve's mom's funeral. And Bucky's trying to convince Steve to move in with him and being supportive and whatnot. And, like, they use the line, I'm with you till the end of the line, which Bucky says to Steve to let him know that he's with him till the very end and he'll always be there for him.
And it was a line that was used in the first Captain America film, too.
Was it really?
Yep.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, remember, it was before the operation.
Yep. 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 So they infiltrate the, like, control room, which is in control of the three helicarriers or whatever, and Steve gets on the comms and he gives, you know, an epic battle cry about freedom and dignity in the American way. And Sam just kind of looks at it like, did you write that down? Like, or did that just, like, come out of your head right just now? Like, Sam's a little awestruck, which, like, we can't blame him.
But one of the great things, though, is that as the speech is going on, you can see the people who are clearly Hydra, you know, going onto their mission of getting into these helicarriers, and you can see the people who are like, fuck, really? One F-bomb, there you go. Sorry. And they feel like, okay, we need to fight back. And you see, like, people trying to keep the doors closed so the Hydra people can't get in, and, you know, all this other stuff. And it's just, you know, all of this is now taking place while the speech is happening.
Yep.
And then you see in the very next direct scene, because now they know Captain America is there.
Yep.
The next chain of events.
Meanwhile, the Security Council arrives at S.H.I.E.L.D. to see the launching of the three helicarriers.
Yep. Which, my notes.
I gave you the setup for it. It took you a second.
So, in Avengers, there were four members of the World Security Council. They were played by Powers Booth, Jenny Agutter, Arthur Darbinian, and Donald Lee. Jenny, which was Councilwoman Holly, was the only one of the four to return. Alan Dale replaced Powers Booth as Councilman Rockwell. Bernard White as Councilman Singh replaced Arthur Darbinian. And Chin Han, who we most remember from The Dark Knight, was Councilman Yen, and he replaced Donald Lee.
Hold on a second. Powers Booth died in 2017.
You're right. And I don't
know. This movie came out in 2014.
He might not have been doing acting because of his health.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
But anyway. But
the thing is, though, is that Powers Booth, Arthur Darbinian, and Donald Lee were replaced by Alan Dale, Bernard White, and Chin Han.
Yep.
And Jenny Agutter was the only one to actually come back from the Avengers. So it was four.
And then she got to play a nun. So Pierce is kind of threatening the Security Council at this point. And this, we actually see some of the agents rebelling, and one guy refuses to launch the carriers. And so Rumlow, like, puts a gun to his head, like, you're going to launch those helicarriers. And Sharon, as this is probably, I think, her best scenes, like, you know, I think we're going to hold off because Captain America said so. And he cuts her, and then there's a fight, and the carriers are still launched. Sam and Steve basically head into battle, and we get to see Sam flying. So what's really cool to note is this movie actually used very little CGI, which is really cool, I think. They tried to build and do as much as they could on the ground.
I think that was a big point for the Russos.
Yes, it was.
Like, obviously, when they ended up doing Infinity War and Endgame, you kind of put yourself in positions where you have no choice but to use green screen, especially when you're going into other dimensions and worlds and stuff like that. But I think that was a big focal point for them, is like, we want to use as little CGI as possible.
So while Pierce is threatening the Security Council, Natasha actually turns that she actually ends up becoming... It turns out that she was in disguise as the Security Council lady. And she like holds her gun up to Pierce. She's like, oh, did I step on your moment? And she begins to, as Falcon goes for, you know, the helicarrier, Natasha's actually dumping all of the secrets onto the internet. And Pierce tries to talk her out of it. It doesn't work. But so Steve gets one helicarrier disabled or re-enabled. On a different frequency. And then Sam's flying with those bogeys pursuing him was actually so cool, because he's ends up using the helicarrier as a way to divert the fire. And it's pretty cool. Like, he's so mobile that, like, if he was on a plane, it wouldn't work.
It's almost as if he flew like a falcon.
He really nailed that one. So he disables the second helicarrier. That means there's only one left. So Steve goes to the third one, and the Winter Soldier is there. He takes a plane, because there's a cool moment that sadly doesn't go anywhere, where the Air Force guys are, like, running out, and one of them says, we are Captain Rogers' only line of defense, something like that, and it's basically the Winter Soldier kills them all and blows up the planes.
And then there's the one scene, one part of the scene where the guy actually does get in the plane, and then somehow the Winter Soldier just points his gun down and just shoots right through the window, headshot.
Yeah.
So, fancy guns. And then he actually just busts open the door, rips him out, and then flies the plane. I'm like, that it's really hard to do with no door there.
So two carriers
down.
So in order to dump all of the files that S.H.I.E.L.D. has, you need two alpha level people. So Nick Fury arrives, and, you know, Fury's like mad because this is like the man who rejected the Nobel Peace Prize, and who was like his friend for many years. And basically, he says, oh, you probably already wiped my like retinal scan and stuff from the database. But if you want to be like me, Pierce, you got to keep both eyes open. And he actually like takes off his eye patch to scan his Flurkin jacked eye. So Fury, let's see. So Sam gives Steve a ride to the third Harry carrier, and then Sam gets grounded by Bucky. Rumlow is psychotic and he's killing agents. Rumlow's gonna go after Natasha and a security council. So Sam goes there to take on Rumlow, basically. Steve tries to reach Bucky. It doesn't really work. There's a really good fight scene. Again, it's not using CGI. It's all very well coordinated. It's like I said, the choreography for the fight scenes is amazing. Basically Pierce had a failsafe, so he actually kills the security council through the little badges that they were given when they came in.
Which, by the way, here's actually the explanation as to why Powers Booth character didn't return as a council member. He ended up doing 11 episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as Gideon Malik, which was his character name, which apparently was, he moved away from the World Council by the time they got to Winter Soldier.
That actually kind of makes sense.
Yeah, so he had
actually... that security council fudged up.
Yeah, because, his character essentially moved away from the council and went into other things in regards to S.H.I.E.L.D.
That would make sense.
Yep.
So let's see. So Sam goes after Rumlow. Steve is shot. He gets injured, but he still manages to get the last drive into the thing. So Maria ends up being in control of the three helicarriers, and she basically turns them on each other and they blow each other up. And meanwhile, Buck, as the helicarriers are shooting at each other, things are moving, and Bucky ends up being pinned down by one of the
beams.
Beams or whatever. And so Steve goes to save Bucky. Natasha ends up becoming Pierce's hostage because of the pin. She disables it and like electrocutes herself, and then Fury kills Pierce.
And as Pierce, he draws his last breath,
he says, "Hail Hydra."
Yep.
Gotta give them points for dedication, if for nothing else, I guess, psychos. The helicarriers begin sinking into the Potomac. Rumlow is fighting with Sam, and Sam gets knocked away from Rumlow, and he looks up and he starts running in the opposite direction as the helicarrier slams into the windows. And Sam's like, I need an extraction, 40th floor. And Nat and Fury go and save Sam from the 41st floor, excuse me. And he jumps in and the helicopter catches him because it's significantly lower. And Sam's like, I said 41st. And Natasha or Fury, somebody says like, it's not like the numbers are on the outside.
Yeah, it was Fury. Yeah. Great line. So, because that's a line that Samuel L. Jackson would deliver.
Yeah, that's true. So Steve saves Bucky. He tries to reach him again, but Bucky says he doesn't know him or whatnot. There's more fighting. And Steve decides not to fight anymore. Bucky like punches him a couple times and he says, like, I'm with you till the end of the line. And I guess that's enough to like trigger something in Bucky, but enough that like he stops trying to kill Steve and Steve plummets into the water. But Bucky ends up pulling him out and then just kind of abandons him there, but it's fine. He wakes up in the hospital a little while later and you have Marvin Gaines playing in the background. And Steve opens his eyes and says, on your left, because Sam is sitting on his.
Right.
Yeah. So Steve recovers.
I like how the little things always find their way back.
Sharon moves to the CIA. Maria gets a job at Stark Industries.
That we know of. She's there for an interview.
Right now, she's there for a polygraph.
Yep.
Seemingly at Stark Industries. The FBI goes after Senator Stern. Hey, hey. Ho, ho. You go to jail now. Rumlow somehow survives. He's torched and burned, and they're getting him to the hospital. We'll see.
That's the
one. I'm sure we'll never see him again.
I mean, we find out four movies later, but like, there's no way in hell in real life somebody survives that.
I mean, with the amount of thing, like, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if Hydra pumped Rumlow with the same creepy juice they gave to Bucky, because we know Zola was doing human experiments, trying to come up with their own soldiers. So it's entirely possible that Hydra had something cooking, as we will see in the after credit scene. We'll get to that too.
Yep.
Let's see. Natasha testifies before Congress, and there's a really fun cameo, actually, that I don't think was intentional, but there's a guy there who says, like, you should be in jail. And it's actually played by an actor who was in JAG, where he played a CIA stooge named Clayton Webb. And it's kind of a fun note for me because I was a huge JAG fan. So if you're a JAG fan and you know who Clayton Webb is, he is in that that scene. And basically Natasha says that you're not going to put her in prison or any of them in prison because you'll need them. So then, meanwhile, as she's testifying before Congress, we see, like, Fury picking something up, and he takes off his eye patch, and he puts on a pair of shades, and he tortures this trailer that I guess has some leftover files. So then they go to, ironically enough, Fury's grave, and Sam and Steve are there, and he says that he has a new mission now, and that Steve should come with him, and Steve's like, no, because Steve has kind of a mission of his own, and Sam's like, I'm a soldier, not a spy. And then Fury says, if anybody comes looking for him, tell him I'm right here.
And then one of the greatest things about the tombstone is that it's actually the catchphrase from Pulp Fiction. It's that quote that he always says before he killed somebody in the movie.
And what was the quote?
They didn't put the full quote, they put the bottom, but it was like Ezekiel 32 or something like that.
Okay.
And I think it was something about the righteous man. Okay. And it was like, yeah.
Meanwhile, so then Natasha shows up and she's like, oh, you should be grateful. That's the closest thing he says to saying thank you. And then she says she like pulled some strings from Kiev and got Bucky's file. The file, if I remember, I think is actually directly from the comics, just in Russian, which is pretty awesome. And with the exception of like one character who is very important in the comic for Bucky, because he's the one that like brainwashed Bucky essentially, and then later brainwashes Sharon, who ends up killing Steve. That was maybe like his like manipulation might have been a little too much for the MCU, but I guess now anything goes. So yeah, and then now we have to get to the after credit scene.
Yes.
We see two men who are basically, I guess they get the news about the end of S.H.I.E.L.D. and whatnot. And says, oh, what about our work? And says, oh, the twins. And then it flashes to the twins, which is very obviously Pietro and Wanda Maximoff. And that sets us up for Endgame.
No, Age of Ultron.
Age of Ultron. Got my Avengers movies crossed. But yeah, it leads us to Age of Ultron. It's a cool cameo because, as it turns out, like the bad guy is what's his name? Oh, I can never remember. But point being that this movie sets up it like hints at Wanda and Pietro, who are Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver in the comics, who are played by Aaron Taylor Johnson and Elizabeth Olsen. Let's see.
Interesting tidbit. Apparently Agent Sitwell was a zombie in the comics.
That's hilarious.
I'm actually trying to find the note about the grave for Fury.
That's okay. Let's see.
Oh, here it is. I found it. Nick Fury's grave bears the epitaph, "The Path of the Righteous Man, Ezekiel 25:17. This is the favorite line of Jules Winfield, played by Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction in 1994. That's nice. What's on the gravestone.
That's awesome. Let me see here. I want to go to They also, again, Marvel Cinematic Universe Wiki, bonus points. So the Winter Soldier, the mid-credit scene is foreshadows Age of Ultron with Wolfgang von Strucker and Dr. List make their way through the facility where, again, I think they're carrying on Zola's experiments or the beginnings, like the continuation of Zola's experiments with Wanda and Pietro, where they're the only ones that survived.
And they also have Loki's scepter.
And they have Loki scepters. The after credit scene actually shows Bucky at the Smithsonian looking at his own reflection and his story. And that is where we are left with this movie. As far as comic book adaptations go, it's different, obviously. But that's actually a very good thing, in my opinion, because the way that it's done in the comic wouldn't have fit if you did it exactly. But it works very well. And the flow of things with Bucky not having as much, like with the lack of context for Bucky and the lack of his lack of existence in this film, actually, is very real, just like it is in the comics. So I actually really appreciate that. I really appreciated the Ed Brubaker cameo. I thought that was a very nice thing that they did. All right, what else did I say we were going to talk about at the end?
Easter eggs.
So Tony Stark is mentioned a couple of times. When the turbines, and then when Fury asks Pierce to delay Project Insight, Pierce says, okay, but Iron Man is going to have to do a flyby on my niece's birthday party. And not just a flyby, he has to come and mingle. Bruce Banner is obviously mentioned. Doctor Strange is mentioned. There's a lot of, Bucky speaking Russian is a nod at the fact that he was not a Hydra agent in the comics. He was a Red Room project. The relationship between Bucky and Nat in the comics is actually a lot more important because Bucky actually trains Natasha in the Red Room. And then they end up having a little bit of a romance, which is not nearly as weird as it would have been in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Because bear in mind, Bucky in the comics was like 16 or so, 18 when he dies. I like the little nods. One of the things I wish that the MCU would have done more was develop that Bucky Nat relationship, but that ain't gonna happen now, which is fine. You could maybe potentially still tie it back with a different Black Widow, depending on how the event of Black Widow end up. Obviously, I have not seen the movie, so I don't know.
Well, nobody's seen the movie because it's been delayed.
Exactly. It wasn't supposed to come out until November anyway, right? Oh, no, May. It was supposed to come out in May. Okay, yeah. Whatever.
But then not only that, but the other thing is that... So that was supposed to be May. I think the... what was the other one?
Eternals.
The Eternals is supposed to be November.
Yep.
And then you have on Disney Plus all the Marvel shows starting to come up.
Falcon and Winter Soldier and WandaVision. WandaVision.
And then wasn't there another one? The What If series. The animated.
Yeah, but that's animated.
Yeah, but still it's part of the MCU because
It's loosely in the MCU because it's animated and because it's a What If series. It's taking elements of the MCU and What If-ifying them, but...
Yeah, because I know they already confirmed the first episode was going to be What If Peggy Carter was the one who was operated on, not Steve Rogers.
Yep.
It'll be interesting to watch regardless.
Yeah, for sure. So there's a lot going on with the MCU. I love this. Like, honestly, I think this is one of, like I said, this is one of my top, Winter Soldier is one of my top five movies. Because there's just like so much, it feels so grounded and so natural. And it's almost arguably not even a superhero movie. It's a spy action thriller. But this is what I love about superhero movies that Martin Scorsese, I think, didn't understand. And yeah, I'm going after Scorsese. What I love about the MCU is that it's not just one type of film. You can't tell me that Ant-Man and Age of Ultron are the same type of movie, because they're not.
With Ant-Man, it was more comedic.
It's comedic. It's a little bit of a heist movie. Endgame is a little bit more serious, arguably. Well, not arguably. It's darker. There's different stakes. It's the same way, like, comparing The Winter Soldier, to Infinity War or whatever.
And well, not only that, but I think the other thing that Scorsese doesn't get is the fact, if you start with Iron Man 1 and you work your way all the way up to Spider-Man Far From Home, which is the end of Phase 3 and of the whole Infinity Saga.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch every single movie, it tells a much bigger, broader story through all these different varieties of genres. And I think that's also something that he's missing, is that it's not just this small story.
If I can sit through 3 hours of The Irishman, he can sit through more than one Marvel movie.
I haven't seen The Irishman yet, but yet again, I don't have Netflix.
It's not a bad movie. It's just long.
I like the one really Oscar. I like the Oscar shot that what's his name? I think Chris Rock was the one who did it, where they're like, "We love season one of The Irishman."
Yeah. Anyway, a couple of other notes that I guess Scarlett Johansson and Chris Evans actually wrote a lot of their own dialogue for this movie, which actually I think is great, because the two have worked on projects, had worked on projects even before they were both in the MCU.
I believe Scott Pilgrim was one of them.
Is Scarlett Johansson in Scott Pilgrim?
I don't know. I just know
they did the, what was it, the Babysitter Diary or something, where Scarlett Johansson plays a babysitter and then Chris Evans is her love interest or something. So they have known each other for a good chunk of time before they worked together. And I think that really shows. The dialogue felt very natural. Anthony Mackie was very disappointed he didn't get to wear a red spandex suit, which I think is adorable. Let's see here.
There it is.
And like, a lot of people complained about this film that, like, oh, well, the Avengers didn't show up. And I'm like, Steve doesn't really have time to call people. Like, there's so many things happening right now. Tony Stark's life has been destroyed at this point. Thor's off world. Or is he back with Peggy, with the... doesn't he go to Earth at the end of Dark World?
Thor? Yeah, he does.
Okay, fine. Like, but Steve has no way of knowing that. And, like, Bruce Banner? Not helpful.
So, Little Shop of Horrors, in pre-production status.
Is Chris Evans playing the dentist?
Chris Evans, Oren Scrivello, Scarlett Johansson, Audrey, Taron Egerton, Seymour Krelborn, which was...
Oh my god, he's going to be so good at that. I love him.
Billy Porter playing the voice of Audrey 2. And that's it so far. And these are
just... Oh my god, Billy Porter is Audrey.
And these are just rumored. Yeah, the only two that are confirmed is Billy Porter is the voice of Audrey 2 and Abby Bowe as editor's wife, Life Magazine. Whereas Scarlett Johansson, Chris Evans, and Taron Egerton are all rumored at the moment.
I know Chris said he wanted to. I kind of hope Scarlett is not Audrey, just because I don't think it's a role that does anything for her.
Honestly, if they ever bring the dentist, they have to bring Steve Martin back.
Steve Martin was an excellent dentist.
But the other thing is that Steve Martin can also sing. And to see Steve Martin sing the dentist song again.
Yeah, but we don't know. I think Chris Evans said he did a lot of theater as a kid, so it's very possible he's musical.
Well, the character that he's playing, if I remember Oren Scrivello correctly, I think he's the abusive boyfriend of Audrey.
Oh, that's wait, weren't they the same thing?
Mm-mm. Oh, wait, actually, I think he was, yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was the dentist and he was extremely abusive towards Audrey. Yeah.
I was like, wait a minute.
Now the question is, do we get the real ending or do we get the theatrical version?
The happy ending or the not so happy ending?
Yeah. Well, the theater version of Little Shop of Horrors is the not so happy ending. And they actually did film that. And if you bought like the collector's edition or like the 25th anniversary or whatever, it actually comes with the original ending.
Yeah, I watched the original ending first. I was like, wait, this is not the ending that everybody talked about. And I was like, oh.
This is the original one, not the one they put in theaters.
Yeah.
Because apparently they tested that and everyone was like, the executives were like, we don't like this. We want people to be happy when they leave the theater.
So just to backtrack a little bit back to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Samuel Jackson makes an interesting point. He says, almost everything that comes out of Nick Fury's mouth is a lie in some sense. He has to ask if he is even lying to himself, which is very interesting. Let's see. At around the Pierce is opening his refrigerator, a jar of Newman's own sauce is visible on the shelf, an apparent homage to Redford's longtime friend and two-time co-star Paul Newman.
So great.
This is the best. In an attempt to prevent spoilers and keep secrecy, the working title of this movie was Freezer Burn.
That's accurate.
I believe it. The filmmakers described the Winter Soldier as a negative image of Captain America. All due respect to the Russos, that's a very simplified way of looking at it.
Uh-oh.
So it's not like it's bad necessarily.
real quick, were you getting the wrap-up sign from home?
No, I was giving the sign to remember to leave food for the cat.
Oh.
For the night. But I wouldn't describe Bucky is not just a darker version of Steve. The Winter Soldier as a negative image. It's the antithesis. Antithesis?
He's the opposite.
He's the foil. The literal exact opposite. Steve is hopeful. Winter Soldier is depressing. It's like light and dark, good versus evil, like
Joker and Batman.
Not exactly, because the difference is that like Bucky, the Winter Soldier in a lot of ways is a tragic hero because at the end of the day, the horrible stuff that he does is not out of his own free will. He has no free will. And therein lies the tragedy. And one of the things that I hope, part of me hopes will make it into the MCU is the trial of Captain America. One, because it allows you to pull in another villain from Captain America lore into the MCU, even though it's like the worst character of all, the Red Skull's daughter. But there's an opportunity to like really tackle that question. It's a great comic, by the way. Another one of my recommendations, Captain America the Winter Soldier, and then of course Captain America Reborn, the Trial of Captain America, where Bucky, after becoming Captain America, will go on trial for the crimes he committed as the Winter Soldier. Highly recommend. Honestly, this is just a fun movie. I love it. It's definitely, I think we've said this already, like a much more grounded and in a lot of ways, like relaxed version.
But it also did the one important thing that was necessary, which was it turned the MCU back around in the way it should have been going, which was a key thing after going through Iron Man 3 and Thor Dark World. And the momentum actually does carry through with Guardians of the Galaxy, which is the next episode we'll be doing. We're not recording it tonight, though, because it's almost 11 o'clock at night and I got to go to bed.
Some of us have work in the morning, and that's both of us, actually.
But some of us actually have to physically go to work and don't get to telework like the other. shoulder shrug my butt.
I still have to get up at a certain time and pretend to put on pants and go to work.
But then they do lose steam a little bit with Ultron, but they get it back with Ant-Man, which is the perfect foil for going into phase 3.
Yep.
In Civil War.
And so, the problems of Ultron, I think, are reflective of the character of the director. And I think that's something we will touch upon. And we kind of sort of touched it upon when we did Avengers, but we will do that in a little while when we tackle Age of Ultron.
Which will be in 2 episodes. Because next episode is Guardians of the Galaxy.
Guardians of the Galaxy. Which I think is probably, like, the best soundtrack of the MCU.
And the fact that they gave it away for free for a while was awesome.
Yes. Yes, it was. All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up for this episode. Thank you so much for social medias. I'm not allowed to thank them first. I have to plug the social media. Okay.
Yeah, you do the social medias, then you thank the people, then you do the catchphrase.
I can thank them twice. So for me, it's...
For you, it's people just coming up and interrupting you.
Just a little bit. It's just the feline and four-legged friends. But it's geekgirl101 on tumblr.com. And, of course, at geekycaptain on Instagram. You can also see my GalaxyCon pictures, which are pretty awesome. I got to fight some Shigos. It was great. Check them out. And turn it over to Michael for his social medias.
At the Lindenbaum75 on Twitter, facebook.com/x75productions. And of course, for this podcast, you can go to txhdhockey.com/nerdy-notions. With no hockey, because the last time we recorded, there was still hockey. And since then, it's not tears. It's actually been more of a sigh of relief, as you probably have seen.
For you, probably.
But like, cool. I mean, this is the fourth podcast I've recorded since hockey shut down that isn't hockey related.
Well, it's about time.
Yeah. So exactly. But then also, we both have our AwesomeCon panels still on for May 1st through 3rd. But we're still waiting to hear if we're still going to have an AwesomeCon to do these panels at.
Yep. I guess I probably should finish my presentation just in case.
Oh, see, that's the great thing about Awesome Mania. We do a fan interaction one, so we just kind of let the attendees kind of take over and kind of direct how we go in our panel.
That's not how it works with me. But with that in mind, thank you for listening and tuning in. And we will catch you guys next time as we blast off into outer space with Guardians of the Galaxy.